And what happens, and they've shown this in laboratory studies, is that if the mom shoos the child away enough and says, go play, you know, I got to finish this, I don't have time, go watch TV, hands the child a screen, what happens is over time, that erodes the child's desire to help. It's almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy.
You're listening to the Untaming Podcast.
Rewild the child.
Here is your host, Emily Giles.
Hi, I'm Emily, and you're listening to the Untaming Podcast. Welcome back to season 4. Thank you very much for continuing to stick around. I think I've got quite a few good guests lined up for you this season. Next week, I'm talking to Brant Courtwright, who wrote the Neurogenesis Diet and Lifestyle book. So yes, we're talking about neurogenesis. Today, as you can probably tell by the title, we're talking to Michaeline Ducliff and her book, Hunt Gather Parent. I actually have an excerpt I want to read out to you guys because I think you'll find it quite interesting, like I did. Techniques of handling children have not made the steady progress toward improvement that some historians of childhood assert, but instead they have always been tailored, sometimes attractively, sometimes unpleasantly, to suit the times. Take, for instance, the idea that babies need to feed on a particular schedule, every 2 hours, as my pediatrician told me. That advice dates back at least to 1748, when Dr. William Cadogan penned an essay for the nurses at Coram's Foundling Hospital in London, a hospital that admitted nearly 100 babies each day. Clearly, the staff at Coram couldn't feed or even hug so many babies whenever they cried, or on demand, as we say, and so the doctor recommended 4 feedings a day, decreasing to 2 or 3 after 3 months. Initially a war doctor, William had turned to pediatrics after the birth of his daughter in 1746, and he came to the pediatric field with some misogynistic views of parenting. It is with great pleasure I see at last the preservation of children become the care of men of sense. In my opinion, this business has been too long fatally left to the management of women, who cannot be supposed to have a proper knowledge to fit them for the task. Never mind the fact that women had been fit for the task for millennia in Europe and 200,000 years elsewhere. A few decades later, William published his recommendation for feeding schedules. Doctors began offering up advice about baby sleep and their predilection for forming bad habits. In 1848, Dr. John Ticker Conquest completely disregarded tens of thousands of years of history and warned mothers not to rock babies lest they become addicted to it. A rocker, he wrote, was an apparatus contrived and at one time made use of to subdue furious lunatics. Experts also started recommending that babies physically separate from mums at night and even stop nursing. Although the baby's instinctive craving for its mother's presence was recognized, it was more important to ingrain it with the convenient habit of sleeping alone in a cot, Christina wrote. And sleep training? Guess who proposed that unique technique? Why, a surgeon turned sports writer, of course, who wrote under the pseudonym Stonehenge. If babies are left to go to sleep in their cots and allowed to find out that they do not get their way by crying, they at once become reconciled, and after a short time will go to bed even more readily in the cot than on the lap. Dr. John Henry Walsh wrote in his Manual of Domestic Economy in 1857. Besides doling out advice on infant sleep, John Henry also authored several books about guns, including The Shotgun and Sporting Rifle, and The Modern Sportsman's Gun and Rifle. And he lost a big chunk of his left hand one day when a gun exploded in his grasp. So, yes, I could keep reading. I'm looking at the next paragraph, which is equally good, but yeah, so that kind of gives you a taster of what is in her book, Hunt, Gather, Parent. We don't actually cover these topics in our chat today, but I thought they were well worth mentioning. So without further ado, here is Michaeline. Five-year-old Michaeline Ducliffe was born in Salt Lake City, Utah, grew up in rural Virginia, and currently lives in Texas with her husband and their daughter Rosie and their German Shepherd. Michaeline is the author of the New York Times bestseller Hunt, Gather, Parent. The book describes a way of raising helpful and confident children, which mums and dads have turned to for millennia. Ducliffe is also a global health correspondent for NPR's Science Desk, where she reports about disease outbreaks and children's health. Michaeline has a doctorate in chemistry from the University of Berkeley, California, a master's degree in viticulture and enology from the University of California, Davis, and a bachelor's degree in biology from Caltech. Last night she had 7 hours of sleep, and for lunch today she had a pineapple and kale smoothie. Michaeline, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So I have your book and have read it and absolutely love it. And for the listeners who don't know, you wrote this book after traveling to 3 different continents with your 3-year-old daughter, Rosie, right?
Yes, that's right. We ended up going 4 places, but the book covers 3 of them. So...
Oh, what was the 4th place you went to?
We actually went to Malaysia. We went to the Philippines right before the pandemic happened. And we actually made it to the place, the group of people we were visiting. And then we had to come home because of the pandemic. So it was really crazy. Yeah, it was really wild.
So you altered the book to just include the 3 places you were able to go to?
Yeah. And I mean, I think it was enough. I was kind of going overboard, I think. So
yeah,
there's enough in there for sure.
So for the listeners, you stayed in Mayan villages, Inuit and Hadzabi families, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Nice. And this was, right before the pandemic. You said 2019, is that right?
Yes. We went to a Mayan village in the Yucatan, Mexico, an Inuit fishing town in Nunavut, Canada, and then a group or a part of Tanzania where a group of hunter-gatherers live who are called Hadza or Hadzabe.
Mm-hmm. And so roughly how long did you spend with each group?
We spent about 2 weeks living with the families. We spent a little bit more time on either end of that, like mm-hmm. getting setting up and stuff. We lived with each in each place. We lived with a family or families. We came there. I had contacts in the Maya village. But otherwise we came there and, you know, we had talked to some people beforehand and we just told them what we were doing, that I was trying to learn how to be a better parent and asking for their help. And it was incredible. Like, people really wanted to help me, but also they just really opened up their hearts and their love to Rosie, which was incredible to see. I had never traveled with a young person before, and just the reception that people gave her around the world was really remarkable.
Yeah. Oh, wow. So when I was reading your book, I began taking down notes for all these things I wanted to share. I wanted you to share with the listeners if I was fortunate enough to talk to you. So I wonder if perhaps to start with, you could tell us what weird parents are.
Yeah, so about 15 years ago, a group of researchers, 3 of them, started looking at psychological studies, throughout the history of psychology, and looking at, like, who was actually being studied. And in the vast majority, like 90-some% of them, they are looking at European and people with a European ancestry, mostly European Americans, in college towns, so middle-class European Americans. And oftentimes in extrapolating and saying, this is how humans are. But what they started to realize is that that group of people, middle class, European and European Americans, really behave quite differently, quite strangely or weird compared to kind of the rest of the world, and especially indigenous groups throughout the world. And so they actually coined this term weird, which stands for Western, educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic. And what they show in this one paper that was really a landmark paper, that weird people behave really strangely on, like, I think about 10 psychological experiments. And if you test these experiments on really any other group, you tend to see a much more consistent behavior. And so I am a European American, and so we are the outliers in these experiments. And another researcher at the same time, David Lancy, who's an anthropologist, was doing kind of a similar analysis for parenting. And what he found was that Western parents, the weird or the European ancestry people, really parent very, very strangely. And there's actually about 50 things that we do that you just can't find really anywhere else in the world. And you can't find them throughout history either. So actually in Europe and other, in the America and New Zealand and Australia, these practices weren't around like 150 years ago. They're very new and they're very strange. Once you kind of step away from this Western culture, you start to see how weird and crazy it all is.
Can you give us a couple of examples of what some of these, strange practices?
Yeah. So one of the ones that's really interesting and kind of applicable to daily life is that we argue with children. Like, we negotiate with them, we debate with them, we have these incredibly long conversations about things, and we even yell at them. And if you look at if you travel around and you start paying attention, you start to see that no other parents do this. They don't negotiate, they don't debate, they don't bicker, they just kind of say things and then they move on. So that's really crazy. We praise them enormously, and we talk to them enormously. So we are taught, like, I was taught by my pediatrician to, like, talk to Rosie, narrate everything, like, now I'm washing my hands, now I'm drying my hands with the cloth. Like, this is crazy. Like, really crazy. And you start to, like, when we were in the Yucatan at first, I started to realize, like, oh my God, I am just talking so much. and on top of that, like, bossing her around, which is another crazy thing we do. And then finally, I'll just say one more because it's so important, is that we think kids are supposed to be raised by two people, right? The nuclear family. Mm-hmm. And the nuclear family is the weirdest. We think it's traditional. That's kind of the narrative we've been fed, but it is the craziest, like, weirdest family structure that's out there.
Yes. Yeah.
And there's tons of data that show, like, kids actually evolve to be raised by about five caretakers, sometimes more.
Yes. And having read your book and seeing, reading how different the other cultures' approach is to certain parenting situations, and then looking at the question that I've got coming up, I think we will just keep reaffirming just how weird we are.
I mean, I think the thing about it is, like, it's fine to be weird, right? Like, all cultures have their uniquenesses. I think the problems is one, a lot of these things are really stressful. They add a lot of stress to a parent's life. They make it harder, arguing, talking all the time, only having two people to raise a child. These are really stressful things. And I think that's one thing we need to recognize, is that they're not necessary, that doing it another way is actually more common around the world, and that there's many ways to do it, right? One of the researchers I talked to recently said, we just are taught there's, like, one right way. And what you start, I hope the book does, is, like, one of the goals of the book is to say, like, hey, there's actually a whole toolbox of tools that we're not taught. And these tools for a lot of kids, like Rosie, my daughter, maybe work a lot better and could be less stressful. And so if you feel like something's not working or it's just stressful, it's like, you probably don't have to do it.
Yes. And I think one of my, probably my biggest takeaway from your book was how children have an innate desire to help. Mm-hmm. And kind of like what you've just said with the nuclear family, the way our Western dynamics of the family has shifted over the past couple of generations into the nuclear family, today with at least one, but often both parents required to work, the primary caregiver often doesn't have the time or the patience to allow children to consistently help with day-to-day tasks at their pace. And, you know, in fact, that caregiver hasn't even had that behavior modeled to them, so it no longer even comes naturally.
That's right.
Do you think you could share with us just why it is so important for us to allow children to help?
So again, this is something weird, is that we think that children don't want to help. Like, if you they've done studies on this with European American moms, they ask them, like, they set up these situations to see what the parent believes the child's motivation is. I can tell you, it's like they ask the mom, like, okay, a little small child comes, like 2-3 years old, comes over while you're doing the laundry and starts throwing the laundry around. And they ask the moms, like, what do you do? And the European American moms say, well, I tell her to go play. She's making a mess. And so we actually think children don't want to help. We think that they would rather play. And then they did the same situation. And this is very weird. They asked the same question to Maya moms in the Yucatan. And the Maya mom says, well, I'm kind of mad because the child's making a mess, but then I'm happy that the child is interested in the laundry, and I start to show her how to do the laundry. Now, of course, she's three. She can't do the laundry, but the mom is already starting to teach the child how to do the laundry. But she's also teaching the child how to cooperate with her, and she's also encouraging the child to help by keeping her there, right? And
yes.
But the difference here is that which I think I've just really started to understand, is the Maya mom thinks the child wants to help, right? And that the child is there because she wants to help. And actually, the Maya mom, if you look at science, is more correct. Young children really do want to help. And what happens, and they've shown this in laboratory studies, is that if the mom shoos the child away enough and says, go play, you know, I gotta finish this, I don't have time, go watch TV, hands the child a screen, what happens is over time that erodes the child's desire to help. It's almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, if the mom thinks the child doesn't want to help and would rather play, over time the child will come to learn, like, this isn't for me doing the laundry. My job is to go play. My job is to watch cartoons or whatever. Yeah. And this is a very unique trajectory that occurs in our culture. In most cultures, children are welcomed to help, welcomed to be there, guided and asked to participate with little tiny tasks. And what ends up happening is by the time the child's 6, 7, 8 years old, they start to become competent and also still wanting to help. Yes. It's a really big part of the differences in, you know, a 12-year-old Maya kid and a 12-year-old kid in Silicon Valley in the Bay Area in the US. You know, that 12-year-old in the Yucatan has been involved, watching, asked to participate, welcomed, you know, for 12 years in the family activities. And the child in Silicon Valley has had 12 years of doing other things and literally been pushed away.
Yes, this is why, you know, it's so important that this working alongside other members of the household is normalized from toddlerhood.
This is the first thing people say, absolutely, it's the easiest time. Like, if you got to start, you got to start. And even babies, like, they have the babies nearby while they're doing things and stuff. But I always say that, like, kids are so changeable and so malleable. And it's another Western view that, like, kids get stuck in their ways. Like, the technique still works on older children, because I have used it on my niece and on my husband. So, you know, it does work. It takes a little bit more time, and you have to be a little bit more gentle, but you can get that. All humans have, like, a flame inside of them that wants to help. And it's our, like, Western view that people don't, but data really show that they do. It makes us feel good. We are cooperative creatures. We are cooperative species. And you really just have to kind of fan that flame a little bit, gently, and it comes out. I promise you.
And I guess, like, when a young child's, or yeah, anyone is learning to help, they start off clumsy, but with practice they're learning and then maintaining that love for helping. But I guess another aspect to be aware of is that we also need to resist the urge to correct them, right?
Yeah, and I mean, it's interesting the word correct, because a lot of the, if you look in the literature, the Maya parents and a lot of the parents in the communities in the book, they will say you can guide the child. You know, mm-hmm. you can see. I think what happens, what I've seen in the U.S. is, and what I used to do is like kind of take control of it, right? So Rosie's like coming to help me in the kitchen, and I'm like, and I would do this to my husband too. Like, no, that's not right. That's not how you do it. Let me show you, right? And like kind of push him out of the way, and kind of it becomes me demonstrating and instructing, right?
Yeah.
And I think what you're getting at is this idea of like, okay, Rosie comes in, or my niece or whoever, and starts to try to cut the carrots or cut the zucchini or make the kebabs, as the scenario is in the book. And instead of just all that right away being like, that's not right, and correcting, as you say, which I think is a great word, just letting them kind of do it, you know, letting them kind of give it a stab in their own way, and maybe guiding a little bit, like, oh, could you cut them a little smaller, or maybe like this, show them, you know, maybe a little bit like this. Because I think they people do want to learn, you know, but when in doubt, yes, be quiet. As long as they're not going to hurt themselves, step back and let them do it, and let them have a chance to really contribute. And what you will find is that this will make them want to help more.
Mm.
This is very motivating for children.
And what if, you know, they get to a point where, you know, I've had enough helping today, I don't want to do this task anymore, or they're not interested in doing that specific thing that day? We don't want to force them, right?
Absolutely. And this is something that I didn't appreciate until you kind of see it, but it's like, if you force them, number one, it's going to make them not want to help, like over time. Most kids, some kids, you know, kids are all different, but in general, when people are forced to do things, they don't want to do it over time. Yeah. But I think it's really interesting, because all the parents will tell you that the quicker and the easier, the faster the task is, the more likely a kid's going to do it. And so, if they come and they help a little bit, like, we're talking about, that's another thing I think people don't appreciate, is we're talking about helping 10 minutes a day, you know, 5 minutes at breakfast, you know, 5 minutes after, maybe 5 minutes at dinner, you know, and then help clean up dinner 5 minutes. They're not going to stick around for 30 minutes while you make the whole meal. You know, kids just aren't built like this. They're built to like come in and out. And one of the moms in the Yucatan said, you know, like the quicker, the easier the task is for them, especially if they're not into helping, you want it to make it quick and easy. And then they don't even feel like they've been put out, right? So for instance, if it's time to clean up dinner, and Rosie's kind of being kind of, you know, grumbling, I don't want to clean up dinner, then it's like, I make it super easy for her. Like, I start handing her the plates at the dinner table, right? And like, she's running around, and as she runs around, I'm like handing her the plates, right? And so it's like, it's more of like a being in the flow and just letting things kind of flow than orchestrating and micromanaging it.
Right.
And over time they learn. It's incredible. Like, because they're watching and they're there, that's huge. They pick up on things you don't even realize they're picking up on. But also just because they're doing it every day, right? Or a few times a week. Think about how much practice that adds up, you know? They learn. Mm. You don't need to force it. You don't need to push it so hard. It really can be easy, and then it becomes more fun for them, and it becomes social, and that's much more motivating.
Yeah. I liked how in your book you gave summaries with tips for parents at the end of the chapters. So I wondered if you could share maybe just a couple of tips for parents of toddlers, but also older children, to help reinforce helping, or possibly restore it for older children who have, you know, lost that motivation to help.
Yeah. You know, for younger children, it really is about giving them these, well, first of all, never shooing them away. Like, even if they start to make a mess, you know, like it's like, you want to kind of try to guide it. Right. And the Maya moms were funny, because they do at some point shoo the child away if they're really being a jerk. You know, when it's like a really like extreme, like, oh, they're wasting a lot of resources or they're, but otherwise they try to figure out a way to include the child. So you try to like channel it. So for instance, if Rosie comes over when she was smaller, let's say she's three, and she comes over and she wants to help with the dishes and she starts like, you know, throwing the water everywhere, making a giant mess, right? My instinct is to say, get out of here, right? But instead guide it, like hand her a plate and hand her a sponge and give her a tiny, tiny task to do. So I give a lot of these in the book. Like in the kitchen, there's tons. You know, kids can learn to crack eggs. They can stir pots. They can, you know, start off with a little steak knife and cut, you know, something soft like a banana. They can grab stuff from the refrigerator or the cabinets. You know, one of the things I got Rosie really into, you know, helping me with the dishes from the dishwasher is because I would let her stand on the counter to put the plates away. And so this was always like this treat, like I get to stand on the counter. But again, it's very tiny tasks. So with kids, what psychologists have shown is it's not the size of the task that's important. It's that they can do it without thinking much. So when we're cleaning up the living room, it's like, go grab the vacuum, put this book away, you know, grab the trash can, you know, it's a very tiny task, but they have to be real. So you can't give them fake work, like give them fake food to chop, or you sweep or wipe the counter and then you tell them to wipe the counter. The kids know that this is fake and they're not actually contributing, and it won't motivate them. The other thing you can do, and so if we move on to older kids, so younger kids are easy. You just say, hey, come over and help me with dinner. You know, if they you know, are just hanging out or whatever, come over and help me with dinner. And then you give them these little tasks. With older kids or kids that don't want to help, I think you do the same thing. You invite them over, but maybe don't say, come help me with dinner. Instead, like, tell them just to come over and hang out with you and then ask them about something they're really interested in. Get them talking make it a social event. That's really a difference that between Western culture and many other cultures is helping and doing things around the house is this social event where children and siblings work together and hang out together, and kids want to be with their parents, even older ones. So once they're there and they're talking and they're relaxed, then you start giving them those tiny, tiny subtasks to do. Mm-hmm. Go, you know, grab the onion from the refrigerator, you know, or can you get this, you know, preheat the oven, or you just give them these little tiny things to do. And all you need is like two or three a day. And what ends up happening is, one, the child is near you, and so they're learning to cook. I'm telling you, they will learn to cook in like 6 months if you do this. I've seen it work. And they don't feel like you're bossing them around, right? It's this like social event, and they're just, and the tasks are so small that they don't even register as like, I'm being bossed around and told what to do, right? Mm-hmm. The other thing I would say to do is, there's two other key things, I think. The other thing is, stop thinking of chores as individual tasks. So we focus on individual goals and individual accomplishments. Like, we're like, oh, look what Rosie did. She baked this cake, or she made breakfast, or look what Rosie made her bed. And we tell them, go make your bed, right? Fold your clothes. And if you really want kids to be cooperative and on your team and helpful, it's so much more effective to do everything as a group. So we're all going to clean. So in the Duclef household, after dinner, we all clean up together. Me, my husband, Rosie, and even the dog, like, licks the plates. but it's like this group effort. And we all make each other's beds. We all fold each other's laundry. And what that does is it takes the eye out of it. And it takes the competition and the, like my husband and I used to fight over who's doing the laundry or who's washing the dishes. Like, well, I washed them yesterday, and we would have these arguments, and Rosie's never going to want to be helpful if we're arguing over it. Right. Mm. So that made a big, big difference in our household, is like changing it from the task, your task versus our tasks. And then finally, the last thing, and this one's hard for some people. It wasn't hard for me. I just stopped. The kid has to be there, right? Like, we think the kids are just born knowing how to do the dishes or knowing how to do laundry or knowing how to cook. And the truth of the matter is, they need to learn it just like they learn violin or soccer or art class, right? And so you have to make time in their schedule for them to be with you while you're doing these things. And it doesn't have to be every day, and it doesn't have to be huge, but like at least once a week, the child has to see you do the task you want them to do and be involved in it. So
nice. Well, thanks for sharing those. I think another one of my biggest takeaways from your book was about child-centered activities. So
yes.
I believe it was your time in the Mayan village that showed you, you know, just how weird we are with these distinctions of family responsibilities and child-centered activities, which is kind of what you've just said here with everybody doing, you know, the dishes together and making beds together. So can you share... Yeah, just share with us what you learned here about child-centered activities.
Yeah, this is one of the craziest things we do. Like, really, children have never had these activities in their lives before. Like, we're running on a crazy experiment on children. And what they child-centered activities are things that are made just for children. So, and that adults don't participate in, or they only participate in because they're a parent. So, like, birthday parties for kids, zoos, museums, like, you know, all the classes that we take them to, art classes, music classes, all these things, play areas, playgrounds, like all these things that are just made for children. And what it does is it separates the child world and the adult world. And that has a lot of repercussions in our lives. And I argue in the book that that's one of the reasons why kids aren't helpful. Because they are never around the parents when they're actually doing the adult activities. But they also, for Rosie, they caused her to misbehave because she didn't want to leave those things, right? A lot of these activities are like massive dopamine dump in their brain, like super pleasurable, right? Birthday parties, these museums that are like super stimulating. And a lot of them are entertainment, right? And she didn't want to leave those. And so what I started to notice was she behaved really badly after these things were done and didn't want to be helpful. And it made sense. But the other thing that happens is when a child is raised really only with child-centered activities and the schedule from morning till bedtime is packed with them, they don't learn how to be in an adult world. They don't learn the skills needed to be an adult. And one of the researchers that's in the book, Susan Gaskin, said, you know, I think we're really just like doing children a disservice. We think we're doing something really nice for them, and this is what they want, and this is what they need. But in actuality, I think being in the adult world and doing adult activities with us is a much richer, much more fulfilling life and gives the child purpose.
Yes. There was a great example you gave in your book, and I think you kind of already shared it with how, you know, in our culture, we're teaching children to, say, play with Lego or do some activity quietly while we're doing all the other household things with regards to, you know, helping around the house. So it's reinforcing to the child that is their role in the family, to play, to do those other things separate.
That's right. That's right. Yes. And one of the Maya researchers, Barbara Rogoff, said that, like, in Maya culture, everybody has a purpose in life, even children, even toddlers. And so I started wondering, like, well, what's Rosie's purpose, right? Which is kind of what you're getting at. And and it's like, yeah, do I want her purpose to be to go to classes, soccer classes, and, you know, go to birthday parties on the weekend? Or do I want her purpose to be, you know, learning to cook the family a meal, learning to help take care of the house, the garden? And I can see from Rosie's response that those second factors, the things that are part of the family, bring her so much joy and happiness. It's a deeper joy and happiness because I think it gives her purpose. And it teaches her to cooperate and work as a team, which a lot of evolutionary biologists would argue that's what makes us human, is that we cooperate and work together. Kids are really made to do that, and they want to do it.
Yeah, and I guess it would come as a shock to a lot of people that in most cultures around the world, the parents do not constantly stimulate and entertain their children.
No, it's again crazy, crazy. And it's exhausting. For me, it's exhausting. Like, during the pandemic, because I was writing the book during the pandemic, and I really, and for there was a while, I was solo parenting because my father-in-law was sick. And I just was like, oh my gosh, I have to do what's in the book because I've got 13 hours with this child every day and like I have to write and I can't stimulate her. I can't entertain her and write this book, right? Hmm. And so what I've learned is that like this other way where you're basically like coexisting with the child, you're not ignoring the child. You're responding. If she comes and talks to me, you know, I'm responding to her. But I'm not sitting there instructing her, entertaining her, you know, playing with her. And that is the way parents all over the world and throughout human history existed with kids, is coexisting with them, welcoming them into your life, into your job, into your hobbies, into your social life, and then just kind of letting them be while they're there. And, you know, within reason of their behavior, you know, not micromanaging them, just like when we were talking about with cooking, it's the same, just letting them be. That is a much less intensive and much more sustainable way of parenting, but it's also a lot less stressful for the child.
Yeah. So do you have some tips you could share with parents for minimizing child-centered activities in the household?
You know, I think this is something like you've got to like make that decision. Because like, it's weird because people will email me and they'll ask me like this, like, well, how do you do it? And I'm like, well, you are deciding what the child does, right? For the most part, right? Unless the child's older. And I will say that when the children get older, they make these decisions. So like in the Maya community, as kids got older, you know, if they wanted to play soccer, or they wanted to take Maya hieroglyphs, then they would drive that. And they would say, I want to do this. And the mom would help them find a way to get there. But it's child driven, right? But I mean, in our world, the parents are managing the schedule, right? And so it's really up to you to say, like, I think it's a leap of faith for parents because, like, I remember when I was first starting to do it, I felt like, oh my God, what am I going to do with her, right? On Saturdays, like, if we're not going to, like, you know, parties, birthday parties, and all these play dates and activities, like, what are we going to do, right? And there's this like, sometimes I'm not really anymore, but it took like 2 years for like this anxiety to kind of lift off me.
Wow.
But I know, and I was really intentionally trying to do it. But what I found was it was like, oh, you just, Michaeline, just do what you would normally do in life. And you might have to make some adjustments so she could come. So for instance, like we were big hikers before Rosie was born and we stopped. And then I was like, well, why did we stop? You know, because we were going to all these child-centered activities. And so I was like, okay, let's bring the hiking back. Okay, we can't hike as long as we could before, but we could still do really beautiful hikes. And so it's really, it's about that. It's like, what did you want to do before those kids were born? And do it and figure out a way that they can come with you and be with you during that. And so that's what we do on the weekends. We do all the things that I need to do and want to do. And Rosie comes along, you know, or she stays home with my husband or with a friend or the neighbor kid, you know, but it's like she's welcome into that world.
That's great. I really like that. Yeah, having read your book, I keep trying to do more of that sort of stuff.
You know, it's funny, like I stopped going to birthday parties right away after going to the Maya Village because I just hated them. And Rosie was just so poorly behaved afterwards. And I remember like a month later, everyone had these canvas bags that they had made at a birthday party. And I remember Rosie was like, we didn't make this bag, mama. And she just was like, and I was like, oh my God, we didn't make the bag. And I felt like such like, oh my God, I'm being left out. And it was a really turning point because I was just doubled down. And I was like, you know what? I don't need that bag. And like, you know, we're just going to end up throwing away the bag. We have too many bags. And like, no, this is not going to make me feel this way over this bag, right? And
yeah.
And I was just like, you know what? We'll get another bag, Rosie. And it just says, you know, like, and it, so I know the pressure, there's a lot of pressure to do these things, but it is so freeing. And it opens up so much time too in your life.
Yeah.
You know? And so you talked about like how we don't have time to like go with the child's pace with the cleaning. But if you do this, you have a ton of time, you know?
Yeah.
And one of the things I tell parents is like, take a weekend morning and just set it aside. It's like the family's going to make breakfast together. And like, that's the activity for like 3-4 hours. And we're going to make it, we're going to eat it, we're going to clean it up. And there's not going to be any stress to do anything else but that. And just see how it goes.
So good. Now, what about, do you have any tips for how to motivate children, like more specifically, how to motivate them without using bribes or threats or anything like that?
I think the key thing there is what we've talked about a little bit. That is, accepting their contributions. So there's this theory in Western psychology that aligned incredibly well with the Maya parents. It's insane how close these things align. And it's like a motivational theory. It basically says like, what does it take to get people, children, adults, to be internally motivated? That is to want to do things just because they want to do them, not because someone's paying them or giving them a reward or punishing, threat of punishment. And what psychologists have shown is that this internal motivation, intrinsic motivation, is way more long-lasting than extrinsic motivation for, when you're going to. And so this is really what we want kids. If you want your kids to be helpful over time, you want to tap into their internal motivation, right? And actually, rewards and punishment and allowances and things like this actually over time can go against that and erode motivation. But what these psychologists found, and it's been studied for like 50 years, and it's exactly what the Maya parents do, which is incredible, is that they found first you need to, the person needs to feel connected. So they need to feel like they're part of a team. And we talked about that, right? Like that's shifting from you go to your room and make your bed to we're going to all make the beds together. That makes the child feel connected to you and to the process, right? So the connection is number one. The second one is autonomy. So that means not forcing it. That means if the child says, no, I don't want to right now, you respect it. That means not like, okay, they haven't finished cutting up the carrots and they walk away. We've talked a little bit about that too. That's really key. Like that when people feel like they're being forced, it erodes internal intrinsic motivation. Hmm. And then the third one is feeling competent, like feeling like I can do this. Because if you feel incompetent at something, you tend to shy away, like really incompetent, right? And so we think that we know this and we give kids praise and we think that that's, what will make them feel competent. But what people have found is that praise can make people feel competent, but can also make them feel not competent and make them feel like they don't deserve the praise. And praise is a tricky, tricky beast. But there's other ways of making kids feel competent. So one is giving them the tasks that they can do quickly and easily. So instead of telling Rosie to go set the table, which she can't, she probably can now, but when she was three, she couldn't, giving her a plate and say, put the plate on the table. She's going to do this task way quicker and be motivated to do it than if I say, go set the table, right? Mm. So that's key. Like that's super key. Another thing is accepting what they do. And so for instance, if Rosie cuts up the vegetables, in the book I have that scenario of the kebabs where she's making chicken kebabs. If she makes a chicken kebab and I take it and I say, that's completely wrong, that's not right, and I like throw it out and I remake it, I did this experiment. She runs away and screams and cries and doesn't want to help, right? Whereas if I say, okay, that's a, thank you for the kebab, or I don't even need to say anything, I just put the kebab on the plates with the other kebabs, and then I say maybe like, oh, maybe we can make them like this and make a suggestion, right? She's going to be way more motivated to keep going if I accept what she's doing. And the Maya parents were incredible at this. It can be hard from our perspective because we are always constantly optimizing things and fixing things and but just accept it. Like they wipe the table, just say thank you.
Yes. Yeah.
Even if it's not perfect.
Yes, I like that. Yes, that you made that distinction that praise actually undermines motivation and can actually generate competition between siblings, right?
Yeah, this is, I think, one of the most little known facts, that a lot of sibling conflict comes from competing for praise.
Mm.
Praise is a tricky thing. I mean, it can motivate kids if it's a small amount and the amount like matches what they did, right? But it doesn't always, and it's really hard to know when it does. And I will tell you this, there's many, many communities that kids never get praised, and they have enormous amounts of confidence, and they, you know, have all the qualities that we think praise are doing: self-esteem, self-sufficiency, motivation. It's a really unnecessary thing, and it really has only been about in the last 30 years that kids get praised in the U.S. I was like right at the generation where it turned. My dad gave us no praise, and my mom had read all of the popular science around it and started giving us tons of praise. But, you know, her generation, you know, our parents' generation got no praise. So it's really unnecessary, I think, is the right way. And you're right, it can have some repercussions that are, you know, really aren't good.
Yeah. Do you have just maybe a couple of tips here for helping us to minimize praise? Maybe like different things you can say instead. I guess you said before about just saying thank you.
Yeah, you know, that's my go. I mean, in general, the book is kind of really telling people they can say, like, they can just be quiet.
Yes, yeah.
You know, in the first trip to the Yucatan, the Mayan anthropologist, Susan Gaskins, I asked her this question. I said, what is like the one tip you would give to American parents? You know, she's lived with the Maya community for 40 years. This woman really understands them and understands other ways of parenting besides the Western culture. I said, you know, what's one tip? And she said, you know, just stop talking so much. I know. And she said, you know, because here's the thing, like when you stop talking, it calms children down, number one, right? If you want your child to calm down at night, just start being really quiet, like have no sound in the house for like 10 minutes. Yeah. Everyone will calm down. Or you be like, we'll have quiet times. Like if the room is getting like intense and I feel the stress of like, I'll be like, I'll start the clock and we have 10 minutes of quiet. And everybody feels better. Everyone feels more relaxed. But another thing she mentioned is that when you're talking, you can't watch the child. You can't observe the child. And we learn so much about a child's capability, what they're interested in, who they are, by just simply watching them. And in the kitchen, if you start watching them, you'll start seeing like amazing skills. Like a lot of kids can use a really sharp knife, you know, by 5, 6, because they've had practice on duller knives. And if you watch a little 2-year-old with a knife, you'll see they really know how to do it.
Yeah.
But my favorite tip, and I think it can really change people's lives, is to like count how much you're saying to the child. So I did this. I recorded my time with Rosie kind of accidentally at first. And then I counted how many commands or instructions or feedback, so praise, I was giving her per hour and per minute, per hour. And it was insane. It was like 120 per hour. It was crazy.
Wow.
And no wonder she was crazy, because like I, you know, if somebody did that to me, I would be, you know, I'd want to punch him. And then I actually did this when we were with the Hadzabe in Tanzania, and I counted how many times a dad would talk to his child, and it was like 2 an hour.
Well.
And another researcher did it with a different hunter-gatherer community in Central Africa, and it's the same. It's the parents average, or the caretakers average, 3 commands per hour. The vast majority of those commands are instructions to help. So go grab something, help your brother, hold this cup, come with me. So like they're teaching the child to be helpful. But if you try this, if you try like set your phone for 20 minutes and give yourself one verbal command in those 20 minutes, which includes praise, it will transform. Oh, I mean, it transforms relationships.
Yeah. Wow. That would be a good challenge.
It is. Start with 20 minutes and work your way up to an hour.
Yeah. Okay. So there was another example you gave in your book that has stuck with me and has come to mind many times in the month since reading it. And it was when you were visiting with an Inuit family and Rosie was playing with another child and accidentally knocked a hot mug of coffee onto a white rug. So can you share with us the reactions of the others present when this happened?
Yeah. First of all, nobody moved. Nobody looked up from like what they were reading. It was incredible. It was, I wouldn't believe it if I had seen it. So a couple of adults were reading and their phones and the newspaper, and like nobody moved. And then the mom, or the grandmother, Sally, got up and went to get a towel. And of course I was like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. And I was like talking like, you know, the good American that I am, like, I'm so sorry. Oh my gosh, Rosie. And I was just like, and she just, all she did was she like cleaned the rug. And then she looked at her son, who's in his 20s. So her adult son. And she said, Tusi, that's his name, your coffee mug was in the wrong place. I know. It's crazy. It's incredible, right? Because she was blaming him, right? She was putting the onus on him to create an environment for the child where they wouldn't do that.
Yeah. And so there was absolutely no reprimand for Rosie, right?
No. And nobody was like upset. Like if that happened in our household, somebody would be like, oh my God, you know, like,
yes.
You know, like, oh my, even if they weren't reprimanding Rosie, they'd be like, you know, just so put off by the whole thing, right? Like, how could you, you know? And no, it was just like, it was like it didn't happen at all. It was just kind of like, and if you stop to think about it, like, what is the point of getting upset over it, right? Like,
yes.
Oh, things like that happen all the, I mean, I break things, I spill things. Why do we get upset over it? That's another good challenge, is try to, when something kind of, when you want to go, oh my God, you know, you want to like burst onto a child, like just stop and do nothing.
And that's, yeah, I'd like to hear what you have to, what you've learned about modeling anger control for children.
Yeah. So the Inuit have these incredible tools for teaching children emotional regulation and executive function. But really, the major one boils down to what I say, like parenting with energy. So essentially, they teach children, young children, how to calm themselves down and emotionally regulate by not leaving the child, not ignoring the child, but just standing with the child, maybe touching them gently in the most calm, relaxed, quiet, gentle, like I say in the book, it's kind of like you're stoned, you're Mr. Rogers stone. Like it's just so calm. And so one time Rosie was in the grocery store and she was starting to have a tantrum. She was starting to scream. And of course I come at her with like, what's wrong? Are you okay? With like all these words and all this high energy. And all that does is make her go higher and get her more upset. Even if I'm being nice, right? And Elizabeth Tagumiak, she was the interpreter for me while we were up there. She was there and she came over to Rosie, and she's a calm person to begin with, but she got super calm, super quiet. She walked really slowly over to Rosie. Her face was like so flat. And Rosie's like screaming, and she points at something and asks Rosie the quietest question. I couldn't even hear it. And she was like, and Rosie just stopped. And Rosie just, her emotion just mirrored Elizabeth's. It was an incredible moment for me because it was like, wow, like I'm totally doing this wrong. Like I'm completely doing it the opposite of what I need to do. I just need to stand there and bring my energy way down. And Rosie, that will allow Rosie to find that state in her, because they mirror, like Western psychology will tell you, they mirror our emotions really, really well. Children, young children. And I saw it again. We were walking home and Rosie was having a tantrum and Elizabeth did it again. And I was just like, oh my God, like it's me. It's not Rosie. And I learned to do that, and I'm not perfect. I snapped at Rosie last night, but once I learned, but I quickly pulled it in and I quickly calmed myself down. And once I learned to do that, Rosie's tantrums like really, really went away like super, super fast.
Wow. Yeah, I guess like you said, if you're matching their energy, you're just fighting fire with fire. You're just teaching it to do that in future interactions.
Right, exactly. You're teaching them, this is how we handle when someone's upset at me, this is what we do, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, a lot of times I would get angry at her when she had a tantrum, but a lot of times I was being really nice. You know, it's coming from a good place, right? Like, can I help you? What's wrong? But it was just like you're saying, just throwing fire. Yeah, it was just stoking the flames because she's feeling, right? Like young children are just balls of feeling, right? Not logic, especially in those states. And so you have to just tap into feeling, right? And what feeling does she need? She needs just, one of the moms in the Arctic said, you need to be the calm in her storm, right?
Hmm.
Not the storm in her storm.
Yes, yeah. I like that. That's a good way of putting it. Yes.
Yeah.
So now, having covered, you know, a fair amount of what you shared in your book today, I feel we should say that it's all very well to want to enforce these different strategies, but it's quite difficult if you're the primary or the sole caregiver. You know, our weird nuclear families don't provide us with alloparents. I'd love for you to talk briefly about what you learned about alloparents, especially in your time with the Hadza.
Yeah, so alloparents are basically a term, I think mostly anthropologists, but also evolutionary biologists use this term, which just means somebody other than the mom and the dad, the nuclear family. So other, allo means other, I think it's Greek. So other parent. And what researchers have known for a long, long time is if you look around the world, on average, most children don't spend a vast majority of their time with their mom or dad. They spend even little babies. So one study, I forgot the group, I think it was the FA in Central Africa. One study looked at how often a baby was passed from one person to the other. And it was something incredible, like 15 different people in like a 2-hour span or something, you know,
wow.
And these are babies, right? These are nursing children. But what is more typical is like, you know, around the age of around a toddler, around that time, 2-3, children start to spend lots of time with other caretakers. And we're not talking about people that come in and out of their lives like a very casually. We're talking about people who love them just as much as their parents and spend just as much as time. And so by the time a child is like 2 or 3, you know, they'll spend maybe 25% of the time with their mom, 25% of the time with their dad. And then the rest of that time is spent with an older sibling, a neighbor, a good friend, a grandma, an aunt, that no relation is needed. It's just that, and usually there'll be about 4 or 5 total that take care of kids. And what there a lot of studies show is this is how where kids really thrive. Like they learn better, like kids learn better from older children instead of adults. They feel emotionally more stable if they have one or two other parents in their lives. It buffers against depression and anxiety. And so we think that like the ideal thing is like mom and dad, but in actuality, it's mom, dad, nanny, neighbor, grandma, aunts. You know, children having these other people in their lives is really, really important for them, and really important for the parents too, so they can take a break. And it is possible. It is possible here.
Yes. And I think you also want these alloparents to be, you know, encouraging their desire to help, being the calm in their storm, you know.
Yes.
You're being aware of all of these sort of things that, you know, that we do as weird parents.
Yes. And I mean, I think one of the cool things about alloparenting, and somebody told me this, is that we don't all do it the same. And so the child sees other ways, right? So things get reinforced in a different way, or, you know, in the Arctic, when a child, and this is actually quite common, when a child is in their early teens, around 12 or so, if they want to go and live with a different family for a while, they can. Or if they want to go live, a lot of parents will send kids to their grandparents or an older family member to help take care of them. They both take care of each other. So the older family member takes care of the teenager, but the teenager also helps around the house, like opening jars, and like it's very interesting. And so, you know, I think that this has a lot of benefit for kids, right? It gives them more autonomy. They're kind of spreading their wings and breaking away some, but they also see all these other ways of doing things, right? They grow flexibility. And for Rosie, it's so great. Like she loves going, and what we do is what I call the auntie network, because we don't have family nearby, but it's like we have two families that we are very close with and we do a lot of activities with, and Rosie feels really comfortable with the parents and the sibling or the children. And so they're kind of like our allo parents, and it gives her cousins and it gives us a break, and we help them too. And it's, you don't need a lot. You don't need a village. Everyone always says you need a village. You don't need a village. You need like one or two other people.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, one of the tips that you shared here was with regards to training up mini allo parents.
Yes.
So I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about this.
Oh my gosh. This is so underrated in our society, but yeah. So like children that are a little bit older than your child. So when Rosie was 3, we're talking about a kid that's like 7 or 8, even a little bit younger. These are incredibly good allo parents. They are motivated. They want to take care of little, they want to be the big kid and take care of. And they're really quite skilled. You have to teach them. You know, you can't just leave them. Like, so when the pandemic started, the little boy next door is 3 years older than Rosie. And we never saw him before the pandemic because he was always at some child-centered activity. But when the pandemic happened, all those ended. And all of a sudden, this kid was at our house all the time. And I loved it because over the course of the pandemic, he learned to take care of her in lots of ways. And he learned to be a really competent caretaker at the ripe old age of like 7, 8. And they became such good friends. And she started going over there a lot, and they started roaming the neighborhood a little bit more together because it's a lot safer. But what I love is I get these kids in as babysitters, like if I have to work or something, and I'm here, right? So if something goes wrong, I'm here. They're not totally autonomous, but they start to learn how to be by making these kind of baby steps towards it. And you just tell them, you like, they want responsibility. And you tell them, like, look, this is your responsibility. You got to watch out for Rosie. You got to make sure she does this, doesn't do that. And you guide them.
Yes. And I think this reinforces how important it is for children to be regularly surrounded by mixed age playmates rather than similar aged peers, like, you know, like it's offered in conventional schooling.
This is so huge too. Like if you can, like families that have children that are a little bit older, a little bit younger, it really it's so good for both sides, right? The older ones learn responsibility, and the younger ones, you know, learn how to behave better. You know, like if a 3-year-old, a 4-year-old's only around 4-year-olds, they don't really get the information about how to, you know, become more mature. Yeah, if you can do this, and, you know, there's some organizations in the U.S. where after school programs have been opening up where kids just hang out in like a park, and there's like one or two young adults that are just there to kind of observe and make sure everything's safe, and it's really cheap, and it's form of childcare, and this is where kids can get this like multi-age play like you're talking about, which is so critical and has been around, you know, in children's lives for 200,000 years, you know.
Yeah, that's so good. That's what we get that through our we're part of a homeschool group.
Oh,
so we
nice.
Just love, we've got that huge age group where we meet together every week. And it's so nice for kids to regularly get used to being around so many different ages.
Yeah, yeah. And I bet you they learn, right? They probably say like, oh, so-and-so, Rosie always says Gus, and this little boy Gus. And like, you can see that it's like really powerful, right? To see another kid do something versus the adults.
Oh, yes. Yes. Now, I wonder if to finish off, would you mind telling us your summary of team parenting?
Yeah, so this is just a little acronym I made at the beginning so I could remember kind of what the universal approach to parenting is. Like if you go look around the world throughout history, parents have related to children really with 5 core elements, because A has 2 of them. But you can remember it with this acronym TEAM. So T is for together, like doing things together. It's the opposite of child-centered, right? Like welcoming them into your life, doing the chores together, being together, not entertaining them, not instructing, but just being together. E is for encouraging, which we haven't used that word, but it's the opposite of what we've talked about, which is forcing, right? E is for learning tools to encourage the proper behavior. As a lot of the Inuit parents say, trigger thought in the child. Instead of telling the child what to do, which creates resistance, you trigger them thought and you get them to figure out. And there's a whole list of tools for this in the book. And then A is for autonomy, which is so important in children's lives. Like, it is probably the, besides the phone, one could argue, is probably the biggest reason for anxiety and depression in kids in our culture, is because they don't have enough autonomy. But also, like we talked about, it demotivates if you don't have autonomy. But having autonomy builds confidence and self-sufficiency and buffers against stress and anxiety. I mean, autonomy is so important. The other A is allo parenting. You could totally put that one in there. That is definitely an A. And then the last thing is probably the hardest. So it's this idea of minimal interference. So it's this idea of like being with the child when they're doing something and stepping back and watching and really only interfering, really only stepping in and doing anything when the child really needs it. And parents will actually tell, like scientists, like it's not about how much you can tell the child to do and how much you can shape what they're doing and instruct. It's really about learning to pull back and doing as little as possible, because the children are made to figure things out on their own. And when you step back and minimally interfere instead of maximally interfering, like we often do, you send the child these messages of like, I have confidence in you. I think you can get this done. The child practices that, right? They practice learning to do things on their own and figuring things out. And in the end, you create a child that's so much more confident and less anxious than a child who's been kind of told and, you know, micromanaged in the moment. So together, encourage, autonomy, minimally interfere. Whenever Rosie was acting up, I would just say those things like, can we do something together? How can I encourage, you know, how can I give more autonomy? So.
Nice. And I've got your book open in front of me right now, and you've written like the macro and micro points of how you merge the child in the adult world and low stimulation, that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's really interesting, right? If we think it's either the parent controls the child, their schedule, what they do, their behavior, or there's like free range, right? Where the child just determines all of it, their schedule, what they do, right? We think that those are kind of the options. And I really wanted this book to show that no, there's like this in between where the child is asked to be in the adult world and do what the adult is doing to some extent. And so that is somewhat controlled by the parent. But inside that activity, the child has a lot of room to make their own decisions and decide what they're doing. Just like we talked about, like if they're done making their tortillas and they get up and they leave, then that, you know, so be it, right? And there is like a sweet spot between these two kind of extreme versions of parenting.
Yeah. Well, I will put links in the show notes to your book and your website. Is there anywhere else listeners can go to find out more or to get in touch with you?
I'm on Twitter. I'm like at Foodie Science. It's kind of weird. At Foodie Science on Twitter. I definitely respond on Twitter, and I love emails. I don't have a chance to respond to everything, but you can totally email me at mduclef@npr. You can find my email on the web. It's public.
Great. Okay. Michaeline, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today. So my final question for you to end on is, if the entire world's knowledge was lost and you could only leave one sentence for future generations, what would it be?
When in doubt, be quiet, step back, and watch.
If you enjoyed this episode, you can join the discussions on our Facebook and Instagram pages. To hear more, subscribe for free on the podcast app on your smartphone. We are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and all of your favorite podcast platforms. If you would like to offer feedback or suggest a guest, email us at untaming.podcast@gmail.com.